Today on Vox Talks Economics, women were given more power in the 19th century. So what did this mean for their children? Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name's Tim Phillips. Every week we bring you the best new research in economics. So remember to subscribe and follow us on Instagram as well. Until the second half of the 19th century, coverture laws granted men almost unlimited power over the household. Now, when these laws changed, how did that affect the number of children in a family? And how well those children were educated? Moshe Hazan and David Weiss of Tel Aviv University have just published a paper on this topic. And they join me now. Hello, Moshe.
Hey, Tim.
And hello, David, as well.
Hi, Tim.
David, what did coverture imply for married women, and how did the lawmakers of the time justify it?
The saying used to be that in the eyes of the law, husband and wife are the same person, and that person was the husband. So you can imagine how greatly restricted married women were at the time. So this meant that they had no control over their own children. They had no control over their own bodies. Their men could imprison them if they wanted to. And what we focus on in this paper is that women also had virtually no economic rights over property or over their labor market earnings. It was justified in a number of ways. One was that men became legally liable for their wives' actions. So if my wife can do something, then I have to be able to physically control her to prevent her from doing something that I'd be liable for. And the history of this actually dates back to Roman slave laws. So people at the time were even aware, debating in parliament about how could it be that our laws these days are treating women like slaves.
And so this 2,000-year-old legal convention has changed. When did it change, though, and what control did women get over their property afterwards?
In America, it changed state by state, roughly speaking, between 1850 and 1920. Every state has its own history here, and there was a lot of back and forth between the legislature that tried to give women rights and the conservative courts. It often shot down those laws, and the legislatures would have to pass them again. In England, people typically dated to either the 1870 reform or the 1882 reform. What we're focused on, again, is the economic rights. So once upon a time, before rights were granted, women had some control over real estate, but none over any financial assets or like a bank account or their clothing or jewelry or furniture, and also none over the labor market earnings. So those are the laws that we're looking at.
But David, women didn't obtain any special legal rights over how big their family should be or how their children should be educated, whether they should be educated. But these are the outcomes you're looking at. Why do you think this change in the law might change these outcomes?
Well, it's a great question. We're talking about economic rights rather than control over fertility or education directly. So it's a natural question to ask how and why this should affect things. For the first part, if you think about education of children and the number of children that a household has as being the outcome of a discussion between husband and wife, then the breakdown of power in the household should have a large impact on what the outcome of that discussion is. So if suddenly a woman has right over her bank account and whatever she's earning in the labor force, then she'll have a much bigger say at what goes on at home. Now, the second part is, why would husband and wife disagree to begin with over the number of kids and over how much to educate them? So there are two stories out there in the literature. One story is that women prefer educating kids more than men do. And if you're going to invest in the education of your kids, well, then kids are more expensive. You have to spend a lot on school. They're not helping out at home. So you have fewer kids. The other story, and the one that we're pushing a little bit harder with this paper, is that a big part of it had to do with maternal mortality risk. At the time, about 1% of births ended up with the mother dying, and a substantial number of women were horribly hurt in other ways by giving birth to their children. The hypothesis that we have, and we actually support it with data in the paper, is that women just want fewer kids because they're taking a huge risk by entering childbirth. And then as soon as you have fewer kids, you might as well educate them more. And that's actually very relevant for the third world today. There's a lot of papers being written showing that men and women in the third world disagree over this maternal mortality risk.
At this time, though, in the 19th century, there are huge amounts of economic and social changes happening. Many of them influence the power of women or what happened within the household. How can you isolate the impact of the change in these laws in causing these outcomes?
So in our empirical analysis, we take control for other contemporaneous legal changes. For example, changes in child labor laws and mandatory education that affected, obviously, children's education and presumably also fertility decision. And we offer two different identification strategies. The first is where we compare households in pairs of adjacent counties on either side of a state border. So implicitly, we assume that adjacent counties are very similar in terms of their economic and demographic characteristics. So as a result, we argue that we can attribute the changes that we find to the change in the legal laws. Additionally, we also compare women who got married before the granting of rights, women who got married after rights, within the same state and, in fact, within the same county. The results that we found are pretty similar between the two different identification strategies. And this comparison between women who got married before and after rights makes sense because rights were not retroactively. By this, we mean that it is true that once rights were granted to women, all women were allowed to hold personal property and keep their labor income, but their property that was transferred to the husband upon marriage remained his forever. This means that women who got married after rights had more resources under their control relative to women who got married before. And so this comparison within the same county, we believe, take care of any other contemporaneous changes in any other respect, but these changes in property rights to women.
So, David, given this causal relationship, how large was the drop in fertility and did it affect poor and rich families in the same way?
It was a drop of about 0.2 children, which might sound like not very much, but if you think about it in terms of today, when the total fertility rate in the US is about 1.7, or in Korea, it's even 0.9, this is a lot of kids. If you're thinking about the demographic transition that America was going through at the time, which was the overall reduction in fertility between 1850 and 1920, this accounts for about 15% of that decline in fertility. As you might imagine, this has a much larger impact for wealthier families than for poorer families because we're talking about granting people property rights. So if you give a woman a right over her bank account and there's no money in there, then it probably doesn't matter for anything.
Yes. Also, your other outcome is whether those kids got educated. And how much more likely did it become after this that those kids went to school? And again, was it the same for boys and for girls that went to school?
This increased the probability that a kid was in school by about 5 to 7%, which is about 20% of the rise in education over this time period. So this is really a lot. And almost surprisingly, we were surprised by this. It was actually the same for boys and for girls.
Oh.
You could think that that's surprising because very few women worked at this time. So it's not like the daughters that went off to school ended up using that education in the labor force later. But one hypothesis that we have is that what happened to these girls is that they became educated and then they became better mothers later on and were able to educate their own children.
One thing about this, you pointed it out before when you were talking about the identification strategy here. This wasn't an immediate change, was it? Because for all the women that were already married when these laws changed, nothing changed for them. So I suppose outcomes would be the same for them.
Yeah, so this is partly true. All women have these rights, but those who got married before rights presumably already transferred their property that maybe they saved before they got married. Maybe it was inherited to them from their parents, gifts, etc. All these resources were transferred to the husband. And therefore, once rights are granted, it is obvious that women who did not get married before rights gain way more than women who got married before rights were granted. And so this helps us pin down the mechanism because we see in our analysis that the result that we get when we compare households who live in bordering counties is quantitatively similar to the estimates we get when we compare women who got married after rights relative to women who got married before rights. So what that tells us is that it's not a change that affects everyone in society at the same time, but only through the changes in bargaining power within the household.
And of course, the way that you're talking about that, as women having to give up their property as soon as they get married, it really shows that ethically, this was a good thing to do. But I think we're also seeing here that there is an economic justification for it as well, isn't there? Smaller families, better educated families. These are key parts of a structural transformation in developing countries. So, David, is there a lesson that we can take from history here in how to accelerate development?
Absolutely. Our paper basically shows that if you grant women more power in their household, well, fertility goes down and education goes up. And a lot of times we think, especially in developing countries, this is probably a good idea. Mm-hmm. Now, something that I would be remiss if I didn't mention is that we also have a previous paper, the three of us, on this topic, where we analyze these economic rights to women and say, well, what happened was that half of the adult population got economic rights. What did this do to financial markets and economic growth? And we find that it was a pretty big impact. So you can think even beyond the results that we've been talking about today, there's a very, very strong case to expand economic rights, both to women and presumably to other disadvantaged groups as well.
Thank you very much for a very interesting piece of research. It's great to talk to you, Moshe. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Tim.
David, thank you as well.
Thank you very much, Tim.
The paper is called Women's Liberation Household Revolution. It is discussion paper 16838 at CEPR. And the authors are Moshe Hazan, David Weiss, and Hosni Zoabi. This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. Every week we bring you the most important latest research, so if you want to know what you're going to be reading in journals 18 months from now, listen to Vox Talk's Economics Today. And when you subscribe, you'll find that's almost 200 episodes now, and I know that I'm biased, but they're all great. Whatever type of economics you like, subscribe, you'll find them all on your phone, and you will definitely find a Vox Talks for you.